Live from New York City, it's The Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us today. We're going to have a power-packed hour for you, the latest on health and healing. Then we're going to talk with Professor Ellen Brown about several things, the best places to put your money, what you would think would be, well, a safe place. A bank may not be a safe place. What if I told you that the money you have in that bank, in your savings or checking, could be confiscated if the bank failed? How's that possible? She'll explain. Because there's a big problem here. It's called derivatives. We'll go into depth on that. But also, Ellen has some ideas of how we could rebuild our infrastructure. Now, it's going to take a lot of money, probably $1 trillion every couple of years for the next 10 years to really build everything new and get it all working, as we just saw in California with the floods that knocked out a dam that was now at risk and caused 200,000 people to have to be temporarily evacuated. They were warned for over 12 years there was a problem with the dam, but they didn't make it a priority, or they didn't feel they had the funds to fix it. Well, what about all the infrastructures that we have problems with in this country? Isn't it time that we did something about it? We'll talk with her about that. And also, what about universal health care? How do we get there? How can we do it so it doesn't increase our taxes, doesn't place a burden on employers, so everyone is covered? We'll discuss that as well. And then there was this guy named Milo who just had to have a press conference to apologize for some really rancid things that he was suggesting. I watched his comments, and then I saw his apology. They don't match. And I'll explain why, because I'm going to play you his comments, and then we'll have the Young Turks do an analysis of his apology. And we also have a person who's going to be speaking on a topic that rarely gets discussed in our society, and that is an American soldier speaking about who is the real enemy. When he was over there fighting on our behalf, what was the cause? Who was he fighting? What was his experience? We'll have that person on as well. We have a lot to share. First up, we always take a few minutes to give you the latest on health and healing. And this is about the vegetable lamb, LMB plant, can treat osteoarthritis. That's good. We have a lot of people suffering from osteoarthritis. And this was in the ACS Journal and it says, quote, "The vegetable lamb plant, once believed to bear fruit that ripen into what looks like a sheep, produces compounds that show promise in treating osteoporosis, a bone-thinning disease," say researchers. This was done by Professor Kim at the Chung-Min National University in Korea, and they found that osteoporosis was substantially improved when they used this single-item vegetable lamb, which is not lamb, it's from a vegetable. Talking about good vegetables, the Mediterranean diet is great for reducing the risk of depression. According to the latest research published in the Archives of General Psychiatry, one more way that we could benefit from the Mediterranean diet, this high in legumes and pulses and beans and soups and salads and fruits and herbs, we could help prevent type 2 diabetes, metabolic syndrome, heart disease, and dementia and obesity with the Mediterranean diet. Lots of nuts, whole grains, and they also use some fish there. We could help keep depression at bay. That's the conclusion of a new research that was done on the Mediterranean diet. Now, according to Sherry Baker of Natural News, the background on this is that the rate of mental disorders over the course of a lifetime is lower in the Mediterranean, substantially lower, than in Northern Europe. And that observation suggested researchers that the way people eat in the Mediterranean countries could play a role in better mental health. In fact, earlier research has indicated monounsaturated fatty acids, there's your olive oil and eating olives, which are used abundantly in the Mediterranean diet, could lower the risk of clinical depression. And that's what they found out. They did it at a clinic of the University of Navarra in Spain, and they looked at 10,000 Spaniards over a period of 6 years, and that's what they found. Those who ate the Mediterranean diet had far less depression. So, and they looked at 9 factors. The more vegetables, cereal grains, whole grains, not our processed grains, nuts, fruits, legumes, your bean family, and getting rid of dairy, getting rid of meat, and fish. So, big difference. Quote from the study. How the people following the Mediterranean diet, the closest, had the greatest 30% reduction in the risk of depression. So, eat the Mediterranean diet, be less depressed. Now, this is something I found interesting. It choosing your words carefully may improve your health and well-being. This is from Natural News, from Cheryl Walters, and it says, words create your reality. Now, I agree with that. The kind of words we use to describe our situations in our lives are the way that we perceive our lives to be. Our perception, then, is the reality. When you say things like something is a disaster or you're suffering from a disease, you're painting a clear picture of yourself and anyone listening that is just the way it is. Can we then change our situation, or at least the very least change our perception of a situation by changing the way we speak about it? That is what positive affirmations are for. Research has shown that a positive outlook and attitude can improve a patient's chances at overcoming serious medical conditions like cancer and chronic pain. It follows then that a positive mindset can help you overcome your negative beliefs about yourself and your life as well. Saying that someone is a pain in the neck is a good example of using somehow meaningful language. Could saying that mean that literally pain in your neck could manifest? Is someone a cancer in your organization or a family? By firing them or cutting off communications, you could improve the quality of your work at home or life, correct? Well, choosing your words carefully is something that our mothers taught us as we grew. When you consider the powers of words in terms of doing what you say and saying what you do, you manifest the reality you live by your words. Remember this: as you make up your life each day, try to practice positive affirmations that enrich your life and your soul. Stop thinking in negative words and negative stereotypes. Stop doubting yourself. Stop thinking, oh, I wish this and wish that. Put it in positive that you're going to do something. Also, mild obesity, just a little overweight, takes years off of your life. This is from The New Scientist, and this was a clinical trial at the University of Oxford. They looked at 900,000 people, mostly from Europe and North America, to see whether those with the higher body mass index, that's the amount of fat in the body, were more likely to die early. Well, wow, surprise, surprise. People whose body mass index was higher than 25 kilograms per hem had shorter lifespans. That's not a lot of weight. And in fact, he lived 4 years less, up to 4 years less, just with mild obesity. So you don't have to have a whole lot of weight on the body to end up shortening your lives substantially. Now, people with severe obesity, those who are really fat, they lived 10 years less on average. And that was comparable to people who smoked living 10 years less. So what if you were overweight and smoked? Wow, you could knock 20 years off. More susceptible when you're overweight to dying of heart disease, stroke, diabetes, liver disease, kidney disease, and some form of cancer and lung cancer. So this was published in the peer-reviewed journal, The Lancet, the British Medical Journal. So get the weight off and keep it off. That's one thing we need to do. And finally, this was important, and this is from Whitehead Institute in Cambridge, Massachusetts. The scientists there found that overeating feeds cancer tumors. and this was published in the journal Nature, one more reason why we should restrict our calories. So stop overeating, stop gorging, stop eating everything on your plate, all right? And by the way, there's new research that vegetarians get fewer cancers. A vegetarian diet may protect you from cancer. An analysis of 52,700 men and women shows that those who did not eat meat had significantly fewer cancers overall than those who did. This was in the Journal of Clinical Nutrition. So we could reduce our risk of cancer if we went to a plant-based diet. We could reduce our risk of cancer and dying early if we reduced our caloric intake and exercised and ate better and got the weight off. I'm Gary Nall. That's the latest on health and nutrition. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. Welcome back, everyone. I'm Gary Nall. Before we go to my guest who's standing by, I wanted you to hear from an American soldier speaking out. The real enemy, he says, is not the people in these countries that are dying. 90% of all the people in a country we invade are innocent civilians, children, women, older people. Listen to what he has to say. It's just a short 2.5 minute clip.
And I tried hard to be proud of my service, but all I could feel was shame. And racism could no longer mask the reality of the occupation. These were people. These were human beings. I've since been plagued by guilt anytime I see an elderly man, like the one who couldn't walk, who he rolled onto his stretcher and told the Iraqi police to take him away. I feel guilt anytime I see a mother with her children, like the one who cried hysterically and screamed that we are worse than Saddam as we forced her from her home. I feel guilt anytime I see a young girl, like the one I grabbed by the arm and dragged into the street. We are told we are fighting terrorists. The real terrorist was me, and the real terrorism is this occupation. And the ruling class, the billionaires who profit from human suffering, who care only about expanding their wealth, controlling the world economy, understand that their power lies only in their ability to convince us that war, oppression, and exploitation is in our interest. Soldiers, sailors, Marines, airmen have nothing to gain from this occupation. The vast majority of people living in the U.S. have nothing to gain from this occupation. In fact, not only do we have nothing to gain, but we suffer more because of it. We lose limbs, endure trauma, and give our lives. Our families have to watch flag-draped coffins lowered into the earth. Millions in this country without health care, jobs, or access to education must watch this government squander over $450 million a day on this occupation. Poor and working people in this country are sent to kill poor and working people in another country to make the rich richer. And without racism, soldiers would realize that they have more in common with the Iraqi people than they do with the billionaires who send us to war. And we need to wake up and realize that our real enemies are not in some distant land. They're not people whose names we don't know and cultures we don't understand. The enemy is people we know very well and people we can identify. The enemy is a system that wages war when it's profitable. The enemy is the CEOs who lay us off from our jobs when it's profitable. It's the insurance companies who deny us health care when it's profitable. It's the banks who take away our homes when it's profitable. Our enemy is not 5,000 miles away. They are right here at home. If we organize and fight with our sisters and brothers, we can stop this war, we can stop this government, and we can create a better world.
Good for speaking up, because look at the mess we're in since 9/11, and since the neocons, both on the left and the right, the corporate class, controlled by that deep state, have had their way. Look at how much suffering we have brought, how worse off people are around the world, including not having money to rebuild our inner cities, to rebuild our schools, to have a universal health care. In a few moments, we're going to talk to my guest about that topic. From the University of Edinburgh, for our public health segment, one-fifth, that's 20% of the world's food is lost to overeating and waste. This is what they say, quote, almost 20% of the food made available to consumers is lost through just eating too much or wasting it. The world population consumes all this food, but think of all the world who are food deprived. In the world today, we have over 1.5 billion people who don't have enough calories to eat each day. We have 16.8 million children in the United States who do not have enough food. They go to bed hungry each day. So we have millions, billions of tons that we waste. So please keep that in mind when purchasing anything in the way of food. Buy fresh, buy local, buy what you're going to use. But my suggestion is, and I can only offer this as a suggestion, don't buy animal proteins, because you're also going to get, aside from the meat, you're going to get antibiotics. This is from Friends of the Earth. They're talking about antibiotic drugs in America's meat supply. A scorecard rates the worst offenders in restaurants. Let's say that you understand that up to 70% of all antibiotics important in human medicine in the United States are sold for the use in animal agriculture. Why? Because they make a sick animal get through the process, and because they also make them fatter. So let's say that you don't go there, you go out to eat. Well, where are the places that have the least antibiotics in the food versus the most? Well, your top three best would be Panera. They're the best. They have a 98% an A score. They have very few antibiotics. And Chipotle is up there also. And which in Subway, and which are the worst? Which are the ones that get D's and F's? Pizza Hut, Papa John's, Dairy Queen, Danny's, Dunkin' Donuts, Jack in the Box, Kentucky Fried Chicken, a Sonic, Olive Garden, and Starbucks is dead last. It gets the worst rating. So at least now you have another understanding. Do you want to get food in a place that has no antibiotics or a lot of antibiotics in the food? Now you have that guide, so that should help you with that. And also from our public health segment, the University of Vermont has released a study that shows that bees are declining, and that's threatening U.S. crop production. Quote, first ever study to map U.S. wild bees suggests they are disappearing in the country's most important farmlands, from California's Central Valley to the Midwest's Corn Belt to the Mississippi River Valley. If wild bees' decline continues, it could hurt U.S. crop production and farmers' cost. Because why? They produce almost $3 billion a year in produce because of bees, pollination. So what can we do about that? We can buy organic produce. We can also join those groups like the organic farmers, and they have a website, to protest the use of neonicotinoids. Those are the pesticides that are sprayed on crops that then the bee is going to the crop, not knowing it's been sprayed, and dying. So buy organic, protest, let the EPA know you don't want this. And also, finally, from our public health segment, the outlook is worsening for heart disease in America. This is interesting. This is in the Richmond Times-Dispatch. It says, quote, for more than a decade, the prognosis was good. Heart-related mortality declined at an average of 3.7% every year between 2000 and 2011, and stroke mortality declined 4.5% each year. But now the American Heart Association warns the death rate has been inching up. The decrease of cardiovascular disease mortality reduced to less than 1% in 2011, and in 2015, the death rate from heart disease turned up. It's increasing. In light of these changes, the association released a report this week, yesterday, in which it changed its projections to reflect a much darker future for American hearts. Okay, my comment on this, and that is that there's no wonder that we're increasing our risk of heart attack and stroke. Let me break it down simply. When you watch the different food channels, and many are very popular, virtually all the food, from my personal opinion, is heart-unfriendly food. If you watch the one guy who's got the kind of spiked hair, you know, he has a nice rapport with the people. He seems like a nice guy. But almost everything is deep fried, it's meat-based, it's refined carbohydrates, loaded with sugar and lard and dairy. All the things that are bad for our heart, that are bad for our biochemistry, that adversely affect our blood sugar and our blood lipids, our fats. Now you look at the Man versus Food, a very popular show, but the guy was just going morbidly obese. He was just getting fatter and fatter, and why not? He was eating 6 pounds of a given meal, 6 pounds of pizza, 6 pounds of a sandwich, 6 pounds of ice cream. Well, the human body cannot process all those chemicals, all that sugar, all that protein. Literally, it's if I were counseling him, I would say, friend, you keep this up, you are on a death watch. But here's what was important to me. When they were showing the different restaurants in those cities, every week it was a different city, it was always one of the most, if not the most popular restaurant in the city because it gave gigantic portions. The amount of protein you would normally need in 3 days, you'd get in one meal. And these are not healthy foods. So that's one reason. Our culture of overindulging in animal and process of plant animal diets and processed carbohydrates. Secondly, we're sedentary. We're not up and about. We're doing way too much sitting. That's bad for us and causes heart conditions. Third, we're very stressed because of our environment we're living in and our individual conditions. Stress is a killer. Stress hormones are killers. So when you take those into consideration, little wonder then that we are dying at a greater rate. In about 5 minutes from now, we're going to hear our guest for the remainder of the show. We have a lot to talk about with her, and she is Professor Ellen Brown. I'll give you a little background on her now. She's an economist. She's an attorney in Los Angeles. She's the founder of the Public Banking Institute. I had her on earlier in the week, but I was doing a commentary about fake news versus real news, and I didn't realize it was going to take me up to, I had too short a time to really let her get into her theme. So we invited her back for a lot longer piece today. But here's what I'm going to offer you today. Something really, really good. First off, I've got a product that is unlike any product anyone's ever created. It's called Survival Stuff. In it, you're getting green stuff, greens and grains. You're getting muscle stuff, fiber stuff, cruciferous stuff, five different stuff, products, all in one. It's a huge, almost 4 pound container. And I'm discontinuing this. And so the last opportunity to get a great discount is right now. Now I'm going to give you a number. So please take a moment. I won't rush it. I'm going to give you a number that you can call in. This is our order number. I want you to be able to order this. And so just imagine getting everything that you get in green stuff, red stuff, greens and grains, cruciferous stuff, all your cruciferous vegetables, all your fibers, all your amino acids, you're getting it all in one. So whether you want to save it until you need it or whether you want to start using it on a daily basis, there's just nothing like it. Here it is. Here's your number. And when they're gone forever, which will be in about the next 2 weeks. So load up, 877-627-5065, 877-627-5065. Again, for Survival Stuff, the huge container that's got everything you need in there in case there's an emergency, in case you're traveling. I use it when I travel. I put it in a plastic bag. And, you know, one of the zip bags, I put it in one of those. So wherever I travel, if I don't have a healthy meal that I can have that day, I just get some liquid and I take a couple scoops and put it in there, drink it down. I'm good to go. So I've used it a lot. In fact, that's why I originally created it, for people like myself. But then I also started realizing how unpredictable the future is going to be, especially with Guy McPherson and others saying that as a society, we may only have 9 years at the most before parts of our society begin to implode and collapse because of environmental feedback loops. And I've studied very meticulously for 8 years, and I believe he's right. So I'm going to make sure that I'm going to have something that's going to keep me healthy. Probiotics, antioxidants, polyphenols, they're all in here. They're loaded with it. I know of no more nutritionally dense food in the world that's ever been created than my Survival Stuff. So here it is. Last call, 877-627-5065, 877-627-5065, and you're getting a deep discount. And finally, on the first week of April and the second week of April, 2 weeks, I'm going to be doing a retreat. This retreat will be one of the finest, if not the finest retreat I've ever done. I've done over 300 retreats, and it's really affected people's lives in very positive ways. And it's going to be in a beautiful mountain area, probably be, I'm guessing, in the mid-80s each day. They got the hills, got the lakes, beautiful formal gardens, gourmet vegan meals, yoga in the morning overlooking a lake with swans, and meditation. And I have not one, not two, three different artists in residence who are going to be doing art classes where you can actually learn, even if you've never done anything artistic, that'll get the artist in you out, and you'll be able to do stuff to take home with you. You get counseling if you choose, classes on hydroponics, classes on homesteading, where to live in the future, the best places where these cooperative communities are starting. We know where they're all at. The places you shouldn't live, the places that I believe are not sustainable. We're going to have lectures. I do a lecture every night on different issues, on love, on sexual healing, on letting go of anger, on overcoming the dark side. So you get a lot of input. You can do as much or as little as you want. You know, you can relax, chill out, de-stress, take a cooking class, raw food gourmet vegan cooking class. I'm bringing in a great vegan chef from New Orleans who is the chief chef on all these movies, big movies, and he loves to come to these. He's been our chef so many times, and he just drops what he's doing, and he comes because he likes the environment. He likes to sit on the classes himself. So if you want to join me, I'm going to give you a number because everybody has to have an interview with Lou Ann Panessi just to make sure this is right for you. So I'm going to give you Lou Ann's number. Then I'm going to play our latest one. I did a short one for just 1 week in January as a fundraiser for WBAI. Here's Lou Ann's number if you'd like to think about coming. 903-881-7008. 903-881-7008. 903-881-7008. Now let's just listen to just a couple of minutes of real people, unrehearsed, who were leaving on a Friday. 5 days they had been there. Here's what they experienced.
Hello, I'm KB, and I cannot put into words the amazing and wonderful experience here at Gary Knowles Retreat. I came here physically debilitated and today I feel 90% better. I'm able to do what I could not do before. I have participated in a race that I never imagined I would have been able to take part in. I would have never had the courage had I not come. I've learned so much, and now I want to be a viable part of my community as a result of the information I've gotten here. This is better than any vacation I could have ever taken anywhere in the world, and I've traveled the world. Now I know that life is about living, and I've learned how to do so here at this retreat. Thank you.
My husband asked me to say some things about his experiences here at the retreat this week. He wants to tell you that 5 years ago he was afflicted with a very devastating disease, and he hung up his tennis racket and his running shoes. Sorry. Last year, he was diagnosed with Lyme disease. And when we arrived at the retreat, he really felt that he could hardly do the first day, one lap plus three laps on the running track. But during the course of this week, he's gone from that to doing 18 laps today without trouble. And he's played tennis twice, and he's never felt better in his life or in 5 years. It's been a magic bullet, though he didn't think there was a magic bullet.
My name is Matt. I've just spent a week at a retreat, and this is my experience. it was a wonderful experience. I went through some serious changes I needed to. I realized integrity is very important. I met a lot of people. I've been so closed off to people, and it just opened me up. I needed to find some positivity in my life. It's been sorely missing. It's paradise, basically. You really get to experience quiet and resonate with everything around you, and everything's there for a reason. It all works out. I just the highlight is the lectures. I felt like you were speaking right to me, and I have to stop making excuses. It's me. I'm the one that has to change. It's the people. The highlight that you know, you brought everyone together, and the whole experience of that was just wonderful for me. Oh, the food was wonderful. Oh, I couldn't even, don't get me started. I didn't have a bad meal. Everything has such a variety. So many things that I'd never eaten, and just, you know, bring in a piece of fruit that I'd never had before, and tried so many different things, and just nothing plain, nothing bland. It was all delicious. It was like a symphony in my mouth, is how I could describe it. The energy work, well, at the beginning of it, I didn't understand. I didn't feel like anything happened right away, and then I was afraid. I didn't. You had said that, well, maybe you'll have something happen the next night or something, and I was so afraid that I didn't sleep. And then the night after that, basically, I didn't remember any of my dreams, and what I did remember was just colors and patterns, nothing that I could describe as a dream, and it was like a reset, and now everything is, it's clearer. Things for clarity is coming in. That it took a while. I think I had a lot of turmoil to work through, and I thank you for that.
Well, there, those are real people. Now, mind you, you can go up in the mountains in New York or California, and you can do some yoga. You can go to an ashram, and you can have some brown rice and apple juice and seaweed and miso soup. That's great. And then you can come to a place to change your life, de-stress, detoxify, rejuvenate, start over, and have the support team there to help you. It's your call. And it's not that expensive. Far less than what anyone else I know is offering. And we offer far more in a more beautiful environment with more staff doing more workshops than any place I know of in the world. So this is a unique experience, and it's the only one I'm doing for the year. So again, if you want to come, call this number and just let Luann know that you're coming. And we stop it at a certain number of people. 903-881-7008 for Luann. That's the first or second week of April, 903-881-7008. Now, let's go over and say hello to Ellen Brown in Los Angeles, California. Hi, Ellen.
Hi, Gary. Great talking to you.
Ellen, what I'd like to do is I'm going to give you a form to talk about three things. First, we have to rebuild our whole infrastructure in America. It is old. It has been neglected. Some of it's 50 to 70 years old, and it's crumbling, it's breaking. And compared to other countries around the world who have high-speed trains that can get you from point A to point B, from New York to Los Angeles, New York to Chicago, Chicago to Houston, we don't have that. We have this old rickety Amtrak. You go to China, you go to France, you go to Japan, you see some really fast trains. And that are non-polluting. They've got a non-polluting train now that Germany just, and Italy also just created. So we're way behind the eight ball. And think of how much that would save us in pollution, the carbon footprint, by lowering the need to drive cars, buses, and planes. Then we have to fix our bridges, our tunnels, our water mains, our gas mains, our dams. We have to reforest America. We have to create carbon sinks so that it traps the carbon. So how would you go about doing it?
Well, we currently have a new president who is talking about a $1 trillion infrastructure plan, which is great. But the way day, his team proposes to fund it. We're not sure exactly the details yet, but what they've written about is through public-private partnerships. This supposedly would not be, it would be revenue neutral. In other words, it wouldn't cost more in the way of taxes. But the problem is that private equity firms want, and they earn on average 12% from their investment. So where is that 12% going to come from? It will come from user fees. So that means we'll be paying higher tolls, higher, more money for our water, et cetera, parking tolls, that kind of stuff. So we the people will be paying it. It just won't be in the form of taxes. So it's not really what we want. And numerous studies have shown that public-private partnerships are very inefficient and don't really work. So what can we do to fund it? If it were funded at 12% over 10 years, which they're talking about a 10-year program, that would be an extra $1 trillion, more than $1 trillion just in user fees or profits, in other words, to the private equity firms. But in North Dakota, where they fund infrastructure through the publicly owned Bank of North Dakota, they have a program where they fund infrastructure for their local communities for 2%. So if you could do it on the same model that North Dakota is doing it, that would be $200 billion over 10 years. So you could actually save $1 trillion over 10 years by funding it through your own bank. The reason that works is that in North Dakota or any publicly owned bank, the profits return to the public. So you don't have this sort of parasitic drain of profits out into the financial sector, and they have a much more efficient business model. They don't pay bonuses, fees, commissions. They don't have to advertise. They cooperate with the local banks, who are basically the front office for their loans. So I've written about this extensively. But anyway, it's a very good model, which the Trump team has been talking about an infrastructure bank, but what they mean by an infrastructure bank is basically a revolving fund where you start with a certain amount of money, you lend it out, it comes back, you lend it again. But if you did it as a depository bank, like the Bank of North Dakota, a publicly owned depository bank, you could use some of the government's massive revenues that are currently parked in the Federal Reserve, put them in your depository bank the way they do in North Dakota. By law, all of the state's revenues are deposited in the Bank of North Dakota. And then you can, so you start with, say, $1 of capital. You can leverage that through the banking system into $10 in loans. We now know, it's been admitted, or it's been acknowledged by the Bank of England, among others, that banks don't actually lend their deposits. They actually create deposits when they make loans, and that's where virtually all of our money comes from, is from banks creating money in the form of loans. They just write it into your deposit account, and that becomes new money. Then they need the deposits to balance their books, but they've just created a deposit which finds its way into another bank when, like, you write a check to your seller and it goes into another bank. That bank will count that as a new deposit. But where did it come from? It was just created in the first bank. So that's where about 95% of our money supply comes from. So that's the sort of leverage we could take advantage of if we set up our own publicly owned infrastructure bank working on an ordinary banking model. Another possibility, which I've written about, is something in the nature of quantitative easing for infrastructure, where you would just have the Federal Reserve issue the money as they did in quantitative easing. In fact, the way budgets are, or the way the government spends, the government decides on a budget and then they spend the money by writing checks on their Federal Reserve account, and the Federal Reserve just chalks it up as a debit to the government. But then the government says we have to balance our checkbook like a household. And then they go out and issue bonds to balance up the books at the end of the year. And generally they come up short, and that's why we always have a deficit. But they wouldn't need to balance their books. They aren't like a household. They could just leave that debit hanging there, or they could sell the bonds to the Federal Reserve, which then rebates the profits to the government. That's what was done in quantitative easing. It was $3.7 trillion in assets purchased by the Federal Reserve, the major portion of which were government securities. So right now they're just sitting on the books and they look like debt, so it adds to the government debt. But we'll probably never, those will probably never be sold into the economy. They're just going to sit there hanging in the Federal Reserve. So you could just rip them up, or you can just keep rolling over that debt since the Federal Reserve rebates the profits to the, or the interest to the government. It's basically an interest-free loan rolled over indefinitely. So it's the same thing as just creating the money. And the issue is, would that be inflationary? And I mean, it's, I have to go into some complicated figures, but it wouldn't, because when you, particularly like when you build infrastructure, you increase GDP, and so you get more back in the way of taxes. And you could also, of course, you'll charge user fees, no doubt. A government-owned railroad would still charge something for people to ride on it. It would be cheaper than a private equity railroad. So you'd have all those fees that would go back to the government, which would balance the money out. So basically what you're doing is issuing the money first, which is where it should come from. One of my favorite models, examples, is what Lincoln did with the Transcontinental Railroad. In 1862, he issued $450 million in greenbacks. This is just brand new money that was just printed. And the same year, he instituted the Transcontinental Railroad. It was, I've forgotten, but it was, I think it was around $100 million. And in 15 years, they had turned a 60%, they had gotten all their money back and turned a 60% profit. It was finished in 15 years, so it was 1869, or 67, I guess, it was finished. Anyway, so it finished 15 years later, and they had turned a 60% profit on the money and gotten all their money back, and it did not create hyperinflation. And that $450 million actually doubled the money supply. So if we double the money supply today, that means we could inject $13 trillion into the money supply. And if we're all invested in productive things, infrastructure, et cetera, we would actually get the money back and turn a profit. And without, you know, on that model, it would not create inflation.
Good. Second issue. I am of the belief that we could save a lot of money and a lot of lives if we had a universal health care. I'll share my idea first, and I'd like to hear your idea in detail, all right?
Mm-hmm.
You start with reverse engineering it. You're spending $3.4 trillion this year on health care. But how healthy are we because of the money being spent? We're not. It's disease maintenance. In point of fact, the number one cause of disease in the United States is poor choices. We are making poor choices about our diet, exercise, and stress, and the environment we live in. The combination of those four factors ends up causing heart disease, diabetes, obesity, and contributes to inflammatory conditions that lay down plaque in people's brains over a period of time, leading to dementia, Alzheimer's, ALS, multiple sclerosis, etc. So 95% of all the things we suffer from, we contribute to our own suffering. So we have not had a Surgeon General since Deborah Koop who actually talked with the public on a regular basis. And Jocelyn Alders did a little bit. In fact, I debated her on PBS many years ago, and I found her to be a very nice person. In fact, I gave her a copy of my 1,600-page book that I was written by myself and Barbara Seaman for Women Only. Now, if we had a Surgeon General, or if we had the U.S. Public Health Service have a regular PSA, well done, that goes on television, that television stations must air several times a day, not at 3 o'clock in the morning, and on radio that they must air, and that magazines would cover, then we would get the message out. And then have, in every single town in America, we would have town hall meetings about How do we get people off smoking? How do we get them off drinking? How do we get rid of the obesity? Have national diet days using a Mediterranean plant-based diet and using exercise, getting people to exercise. And as this evolves, getting people to take the supplements, first primarily through their food, that's easiest for most, and then through concentrates or drinks like orange juice, apple juice, beet juice, grape juice, etc. And between exercise and diet, changes to a healthy diet, and then stress management, have places that promote and discuss some mindful meditation, listening to music to relax and de-stress, we would reduce our overall incidence of disease because we'd be preventing disease. So that's a big part of this. Separately, one-third of all of our medical bills are due to, our national medical bills, due to insurance maintenance and administration. But you have to look at what they call cost plus. That means that every single expense an insurance company has, their private jets, the bonuses of their executives, all of their perks, all their advertising, all their lobbying, all that is a part of their administrative overhead. They also have no incentive to cover a lot of procedures. If a doctor administrator is able to say, no, we're not going to cover that, or we're not going to cover that, even if you needed it, even if it was life-saving, they save money, and they get some bonus or some recognition, some reward for how much money they save the insurance company from having to lay out. So if you took away that, you're taking away approximately $1.1 trillion a year. So now you're saving $1.1 trillion. Then you also have a preventative program, and you then take the profit out of the medical system. For example, the government, like the Medicare, Medicaid, and the VA, will be able to buy all medications or medical supplies at generic cost. And if you saw what I did, the 10 leading drugs used in the United States, a month's supply of their generic cost versus what you pay retail, it's sometimes as high as 100,000% profit. One was actually 300,000% markup. Like one bottle of one particular drug for a month's supply, 30 tablets, cost 10 cents. It was selling for over $200. So what we have to understand is when the government says, you must sell us these drugs at a generic cost, that doesn't mean the manufacturer doesn't make a profit. It's just not the profit they're making now, obscene profits. So you're going to save about $150 billion on the prescription drugs. Then you take out malpractice insurance. No doctor or nurse pays for malpractice. But you implement instead a no-fault medical insurance, which means that you cannot sue your doctor. If you are injured in any way, that goes to an arbitration which determines the nature of your condition, how much you've been injured, and how you should be compensated, but there's a cap on it to take out the greed. And now that frees doctors up from no longer having to do defensive medicine, giving you x-rays you don't need, giving you medications you don't need, giving you tests that you don't need, simply because they're afraid that if they do anything wrong and you sue them, they have to be covered, so they over-medicate, over-diagnose, over-treat. That's eliminated. That saves another $150 billion a year. Now you've saved $300 billion plus $1.1 trillion. So now you're up to $1,400,000 saved. Now you're treating people the proper way. Then introduce into the school curriculums, instead of a pharmacology, also environmental factors, emotional factors, psychoneuroimmunology, and preventative factors. So then a person who is injured or ill can get any treatment, because you could have four nonprofit hospitals across America where the goal is to help the patient not get $1,400 for them sleeping in a hospital bed for the night, being charged $100 for a $1 bag of saline solution and a drip. No, everything has to be at nonprofit prices. That would save an additional $300 billion. So that's how you take a $3.4 trillion expense, the biggest in the world, bigger than military, bigger than housing, and you make it manageable. And by the way, because of how much you're saving, the savings alone, if you put it under Medicare, would cover the cost of it. Those are my thoughts.
Yeah, no, that's great. I would, and I was thinking of actually writing a book on this subject, time permitting. So I was looking into those factors. I love your research, and I've studied what you've written and your videos. But I was looking at what they pay in England and what they pay in Japan for comparative purposes. The Japanese have the lowest cost to healthcare and the best outcomes of any industrialized country. And that the British have about equivalent outcomes to us, but their healthcare is only, if we did it on their model, we could cover all of healthcare for $1.4 trillion for the whole country. So that's because of, savings in costs of administration. I mean, their model of delivery and of negotiating with the drug companies and so forth that would knock off like $2 trillion from our bill, except we actually pay about $1.4 trillion just for Medicare and Medicaid. So obviously, we must be just not as healthy as as those other people. So what are the factors? So I looked at various factors that could have been it. You would think maybe smoking, but in fact, the Japanese smoke 70% more cigarettes than in the U.S., so that doesn't seem to be it. And the British smoke about equivalent. I mean, you might think, well, the Japanese are just healthier. They eat more fish they eat healthier diets or something like that. So that's why the U.K. is a good comparison. But the main things that are different about Americans, the three things are: we have the highest GMO intake in the world. We have the highest pharmaceutical drug intake. If you count, that's by gram of drug per number of grams of drug per year, not the number of pills. The Japanese actually take more pills, but the doses are lower, so we actually get more drug in our system than anyone else. And we have the most vaccines and the earliest vaccine schedule, where we're loading these babies at 2 months with vaccines. And, of course, SIDS, the sudden infant death syndrome, also hits at 2 months. And then we have this high rate of autism. So now we've got Robert Kennedy Jr., who has been assigned to look into the safety of vaccines, which I think is great. I mean, we have a new administration that seems to be open to some other ways of looking at all this. So if we could, like you say, we have to change our lifestyle, particularly in those three. Oh, the other thing is obesity. We have the most obesity of industrialized nations. But the obesity, it's not like the Americans are just hungrier than other people. It's not like we just are more slovenly than other people. I think what it is that particularly poor people are obese, and I think it's because they're not getting the nutrients in their food. Because of GMO and because of pesticides and because the drugs they take are impairing their ability to absorb from their food. So those things are related. I think if we had studies that really looked at drugs and that weren't sponsored by drug companies, that really looked at their effects and really looked at vaccines and really looked at GMO, if we studied all those things and did what actually works, we would have a totally, totally different system. I know in Russia when they were poor, I wrote a little article on a thing called a Scanner, which is a vibrational thing. And I was trained, they gave me a free Scanner in exchange for writing in this article. And I was trained in London by, it was just a 3 or 4 day seminar by a woman who was a Russian doctor. And she said, in Russia, we didn't have any money, and it was our job to keep the people well. So they specifically looked for what worked. And anything that didn't work and was expensive, obviously they didn't do it. And they did research in things that did work. And they came out with a much better system, much cheaper, and the people were much healthier. So I think that's what we have to do, is not have this profit model for medicine, which is counterproductive. You're funding disease. I mean, your market is sick people, so why would you want to get them well? Why would you want to cure cancer, which is the biggest moneymaker of all those diseases? But besides that, we could just print the money for, just like we could with infrastructure, we could print $1 trillion a year and it would not be hyperinflationary because it would be absorbed. We need more money out there and other to stimulate production. You've got to have the money first, and then people spend the money, and that prompts manufacturers to hire more people and make more goods. And now we have, it's not just that the fact that we have people unemployed, although we actually have a 9.4% real unemployment rate if you count all those people that quit looking and the people that are underemployed. So you obviously have room to expand your manufacturing base. But besides that, we've got automation, which has practically unlimited capacity to produce the things that we need. So anyway, we have a lot of potential there that will only get stimulated if we get money in people's pockets so they can go out and buy this stuff.
Good. Ellen, last question. I'm going to need you to kind of make this tight. We have what are called derivatives. There are $250 trillion in them. The big banks, the big Goldman Sachs and J.P. Morgan, Bank of America, Wells Fargo, they're the ones holding these. They didn't pay that money for them. They paid a fraction, not even 1%. But if they fail, then they get recover 100% of that. Where are they going to get that money to recover? And shouldn't we outlaw these? And how does that impact the person who has savings and checking accounts now in their banks?
Mm-hmm. Well, there are actually $500 trillion in derivatives globally riding on sovereign debt, which is like the debts of Greece and other European countries that are on very shaky ground. Derivatives are basically bets. So there is $100 trillion in sovereign debt out there. So what everybody's concerned about is one of those big derivative banks, say Deutsche Bank, could go down. And because all these bets are interconnected, you've got the big banks betting both ways. So if one party can't pay on their bet, then that bank won't be able to pay on the bet that it hedged the other way, and so it's this whole interconnected net that will collapse. So that in Europe, they have some banks that are, like in Spain particularly, they have banks that have collapsed, and what the government wants to do is just bail them out like they always have done, but the EU won't let them. They have this new policy where you have to first bail in your creditors, which includes the depositors. The largest class of creditor of any bank is the depositors. And in Spain, it actually, they're not even depositors. Once they're worried about it, it's all these people that bought these bonds thinking that they were getting a very safe CD-type investment. And in fact, they became creditors of the bank that are not even covered by the limited amount of deposit insurance that they have there. So they could. Spain could leave the EU over this, or France might leave the EU if Marine Le Pen gets elected, etc. So there are many vulnerable things that could happen in Europe that would cause this sovereign debt derivatives market to explode or to collapse, and that would seriously affect our banks as well. Well, we too have this bail-in scheme in the Dodd-Frank Act, where the banks are required to recapitalize themselves with the money of their creditors. And again, the largest class of creditor of any bank is the depositors. Now, theoretically, the depositors are covered by FDIC insurance up to $100,000. But the FDIC insurance fund only has, the last time I looked, it had $74 billion in it. $74 billion to cover $500 trillion or more in deposits that are covered, that are $100,000 or less. So obviously they don't have enough money to cover a really big derivatives bust. They do have a credit line with the Treasury, but it's only to the tune of $500 billion, which also might not be enough. And then who would pay that loan back?
You're right. It's something for another discussion and something that should be important in our lives. We're out of time. Ellen, thank you very much for being with us today. Professor Ellen Brown, my guest from Los Angeles. I'm Gary Nall, and her website is webofdebt.com. Have a nice day.